I'm Shannon Griffin, and this is Chatterbox. In the final episode for my interview with Heather Mills, I explore her relationship with the press. I find out what she had in common with Margaret Thatcher and discover how she balances the relentless demands of the lifestyle that she has chosen.
You have quite famously had a turbulent relationship with the press. Now, and I know that as a mum, that must have been difficult at times, maintaining your privacy, challenging the press when they needed to be challenged, having endured an enormous amount of abuse, and I think that's putting it lightly. What's your relationship like now with the press? Because they seem to have given you, unjustifiably, a terribly difficult time. And I wonder why they did that and whether you think they've learned their lesson.
It goes back to my accident, actually. When I had my accident and I was in Mount Vernon Hospital, which, shout out to Mount Vernon, they looked after me really well. The press turned up and they made me the poster child for overcoming adversity. I took on that role, went on to counsel and help thousands of other amputees. And every time I met, and they'd call me up and say, there's this young girl's lost her leg. Will you come and meet her? Can we have a picture of you two together? So I would say, yes, if you give the family enough money to get a good artificial limb. Otherwise, no, I'll meet her privately and help her, but you're not having a picture. So we ended up with this relationship that anytime they wanted me in a picture, they had to give the family money to get a leg made, because at the time I hadn't managed to, which I have now, force the really good limbs that we developed that I did for charity, like the running legs and the all the stuff you see in the Paralympics and stuff now. And the silicone high heel legs and all that, they weren't available at the time, and girls wanted to wear heels and guys wanted to do a lot of sport, and girls. And I had a great relationship. So if you look at the press from 93 until 99, never a bad word, same life story, best-selling book with all the truth in there that went to charity, helped clear landmines and prosthetics, no different to life, just different rhetoric from the press, because I had great relationships with all the editors and we were trying to do good things. Second, I met my ex-husband, I was told to be 100% quiet because they wanted 100% privacy. And I said, well, what do I do about my charity stuff? What do I do about this? I'll help you with that, but just never, ever speak to the press, not knowing that he was always still speaking to the press, but I wasn't allowed to.
Right.
But I didn't know that at the time, but he had to run the commentary. And they just turned on me and they said, who the hell does she think she is? One minute she's working with us for charity from 93 to 99, and now she thinks she's Lady Muck. But they didn't appreciate that my ex didn't want me to talk to the press, and they were a very, very private family.
Right.
And I went quiet. Little did I know that he was talking to the press all the time, continued to talk to the press all the time, and run his own narrative. But I didn't know any of that until I got divorced. When I got divorced, something horrific happened that I've never spoke about publicly, and I had to leave. And I didn't want to speak to the press about it. So he was afraid that would come out, and he ran the narrative that I was nuts, I was this, I was that. So him and Murdoch worked together with their team to destroy me, because if the truth ever did come out, then it would be, well, she's crazy, she's nuts, it's not true, da-da-da-da-da.
You couldn't win either way, could you?
No, you couldn't win. So, but what did happen was I realized that I was being bugged. So I started to investigate how that was happening. Ended up doing a sting on a reporter from the Sun newspaper, recorded that sting back. Then it went to the police. The whole Leveson trial started coming to court. Hacked Off was created. You're talking 17 years ago when all this started. Then I went to court to expose Piers Morgan, who was massively involved in phone hacking, somehow has evaded prison, but eventually, hopefully, they'll get him there. And then I basically carried on being vilified more because I was exposing the press. So that's why the press continued to get worse and worse and worse, because I had all of the famous M's after me. But I was determined, and that was the worst time in my life, listening to lies and destroying my charity. They ended up closing down the landmine charity because they basically said, my ex said he would fund it if I was gotten rid of, and he didn't. And all the charities I was involved with just either disappeared or cut me off completely.
That must have been devastating to you, not only being vilified in front of the public and humiliated in the way that you were, but then to have the things that meant so much to you taken away from you.
Well, it was more than that. It was way more than me. I knew that if I wasn't involved with it, because I was very involved with it, you got some people that just took a photo, but I was really involved with it. I knew that people would die. And that's what I couldn't live with.
Yeah.
So hundreds of thousands of people were being blown up and dying because we could no longer demine at the speed we had been. So because of what happened, they closed the whole charity down. So I was kicked out and I said, kick me out and nobody will continue it. You will not get the support you're being promised. And they didn't. And the whole thing was shut off. So I said, right, I'm going after the newspapers. So I was determined, started investigating, and eventually won the largest settlement in the history of ever, which went into good causes. And basically, they backed off from there on.
What did that day feel like?
Oh, it was, you can imagine, it was so cathartic. And the reason it felt really good was because some people had gone through even worse. Some people's kids had been killed and they'd misconfused information by bugging their voicemail, thinking the child was still alive. It was way, and many others, and it was just way bigger than me. So if I hadn't have started it, that might not have happened. We don't know. But I was the one that had to take the abuse of it all. And I thought, you know what? I've had so much abuse. It just seems to be my life. But I have to say that was the hardest because I thought, why am I being abused for only helping?
Yeah.
Why don't I just become a selfish drug dealer? Not bother helping people? But the things that they said about me then, you couldn't legally get away with now. You know, they would call me hoppity, one-legged bitch, you know, all sorts of disgusting things. And even when they found out in the courts, because they had people bugging the courts, what had actually happened and why I'd left my marriage, I thought then they would back off, but they didn't. And that made me realize there are some really evil, evil people running the newspapers, because especially women editors that can listen to what happened to me and still write abusive articles, you've got to be a pretty evil person.
You must be quite heartened to see that progress is being made on a number of different fronts in terms of calling the press to account. And I'm sure that that will continue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really, really improved massively. And we've still got hundreds of thousands more cases to help people that don't have a voice.
Heather, take me through a typical day for you. What does it look like, if there's any such thing?
It's funny because I should put one of those head cams on, my family say, because it's so insane. When I'm with my family, I'm with, and the phones are off. But when I'm in work mode, don't speak to me. Don't interrupt me, because I'm so in the zone. So I get up about 5. I do all my emails really quietly, or I've got a couple of conference calls with Australia because we export to 24 countries. So we need to speak to them before they finish. And then I finish about 10, 11, sometimes 12 at night. But in the middle for me is like 6 o'clock at night. So at 6 o'clock at night, when I know the factory's sort of finished production and things, I switch everything off and then I go to a spin class. And then I do a 30-minute weight session because I've got, you know, crushed pelvis and things because the plate broke after the baby and lots of broken bones from ski racing. I have to do my exercises 3 or 4 times a week. So I make 6 to 7:30 training, could be swimming, spin class or weights. Then I come back and eat. And then I usually do American work. And then there's conference calls, sometimes speeches, exhibitions, depending on what it is, meetings in different areas, parliament, human security. You know, I was in four different countries in December. And just random things that come up where people say, oh, this has happened, what should we do about that? Things from the past in the former Yugoslavia or the International Trust Fund or of demining or just constant. It would be a variety of 10 to 15 different topics. It's not getting up and it's just about vegan food or it's just about this. I do a lot of mentoring with women from the Prince's Trust, age between 16 and 30. One of them's just finished her law degree. She came from a way worse childhood than me. Prince's Trust does unbelievable work that people don't quite understand. So if you've got, if anybody's listening that's got anyone between 16 to 30 that wants free education, marketing, introduction to jobs, anything, I mean, there literally is a Prince's Trust down the road from you. I wish I'd known about it when I was a teenager. And counselling amputees, giving them 5 minutes to get over their amputation and getting them to get on with it.
You've kind of answered two questions that I was going to ask. I was going to ask a question about whether you were an early bird or a night owl, and it seems to me that you're probably both. And the
I'm a 4 hour sleeper and I used to do a lot of speeches around America at the same time. I seem to always end up on the speaker circuit in the late 80s, early 90s with Margaret Thatcher. And we were the only ones that were left down in the lounge downstairs, just still awake. And I remember when I went to the Queen's 50th, way before I was, with my ex or anything, this is in the 90s. And I'd just got an award from Downing Street from John Major. And I now walked over to the Queen's Jubilee, I think it was Banqueting Hall or something. And I was put next to Dennis Thatcher. And Margaret was on the end of the table with the Queen. And Dennis picked up the little name and went, Heather Mills. And I was only 20, it was a year after I lost my leg. So 26 and 56 in a week. So that's 30 years ago. And he was saying, what do you do? And I said, oh, this and that. And he said, do you have a partner? And I was like, oh, no. I said, I'm way too bossy because I was really bossy in my 20s. I was like, what do you mean you don't understand? Let's get on with it. I was very impatient. And I said, and then I looked at him and suddenly realized, well, hang on, I'm bossy. I said, you're married to someone very bossy, surely. And he said, she may be the boss in the boardroom, but I'm the boss in the bedroom. And Margaret leaned over and said, Dennis, what are you doing? Because we were laughing so much. And then I met her many, many years later at Buckingham Palace. I was holding the Women of Achievement Awards there. And she was just sitting in the corner because she was a very isolated, alienated lady and loved or hated, nothing in the middle, which tends to happen to me, actually. And not that there's any comparison between me and Maggie. She's done completely different. But,
I might disagree with you on that. I think I can see some attributes that are very similar.
But we used to talk about let's sleep when we're dead. Got 4 hours. I know sleep's really important and you should have it and everything. But I literally go to sleep and wake up and then feel great. But when I sleep like the dead. There can be a storm, bombs, anything. But it's 4 hours of absolute solid sleep. And I think that's come from my childhood. I had to get up at the crack of dawn, iron three uniforms, iron my dad's shirts. Run to school, swim, work, come back, work till late. So I think it's ingrained in me. I think your sleeping patterns can be changed. And the other thing is that I, since my 5 months in hospital, having to be on my back and not moving, I literally lie on my back and I don't move at all. And that's become ingrained in my head.
Really?
Yeah, I don't move my body position at all night. I lie, sleep, wake up. I've actually had a
Gosh.
friend on holiday where we had to share a room in twin beds, and she thought I was dead. She came over and started poking me because she was watching a film till late, and she said she hasn't moved at all, like not a bit. But I think that was months in hospital.
When you look back on the life that you've had so far, what makes you the most proud of your achievements? What one or two things stand out that you're particularly happy about?
Having a child against all odds, I was the only person that was loved morning sickness because that meant the child was still alive after losing so many. And obviously, working in war zones and making a difference and introducing alternate vegan foods into the world back in the early 90s with a small group of people and campaigners and realizing how important that is. Unfortunately, there's a lot of mis-messaging at the moment, so we need to turn that around again. So I'm working on an entire range of gut healthy foods for people that have problems with digestion, IBS, Crohn's, celiac. So I've perfected that over 15 years of study and understood why these things happen in the gut. Work with gastroenterologists around the world. So that's a problem-solving thing because I ended up on liquid food for 3 years after I had Lyme's disease. So I couldn't digest anything and I had to learn the hard way. And I was
Gosh.
vegan,
Yeah.
but it literally destroyed my entire colon. So I had to reset that, rework out what I could eat. And it took me years. But again, it happened for a reason because I wouldn't have come up with a solution. 50% of the British public are living with acid reflux. I can't digest properly, have bloating and distension, and we have the solution for that. And that is what I then want to push in the NHS, in the food system, in airports, on airplanes, because that's a ready-to-go, simple eating product that will change people's lives. Because when you have gut issues, it is painful. It affects your mood. It can make you depressed, angry, all sorts. And it is very unspoken about in Britain with the stiff upper lip. We can't talk about our bowels, dear.
Yes.
So it's that's my next mission is basically to raise that awareness and create the solution to the problem, because that will have a domino effect for mental health. That will have an effect for solving a lot of the problems in this country.
It's very interesting you should mention that because I read a book a short while ago about how we talk about nutrition in terms of various organs, but we don't talk about brain nutrition. And how we're getting that so terribly wrong. I think I listened to, yeah, I listened to the food program on Radio 4, and it was just so enlightening. Heather Mills, you're clearly still as busy as you've ever been. What does the future hold for you? What are the things that you want to accomplish in life moving forward?
I'd like to make sure I have the right team in place to manage and implement all the mad ideas, because what I have learned is I can have as many ideas and ways of making things happen, but you need a great team. And I do have a great team in the real worker area. But once you get into the upper management area, there are a lot of egos. I didn't think there was as much misogyny in British business as there is because I'd just always been the boss. But when I worked in one of my companies with an investment partnership, which was a complete disaster because they didn't know what they were doing, but they dictated everything. They put in five guys to manage it and they would just go, "Yes, dear. Yes, dear. You don't worry. We're doing this." And they just ignored me all the
Really?
time. And I'm hard to ignore. And
I was going
they literally were just so arrogant because I went to a comprehensive and they've gone to a really posh university, even though I have higher qualifications and studies and all that stuff now. But there was just this arrogance. And I hadn't seen that before. I'd seen abuse, in my life from people, but I hadn't seen, "You don't know anything, and we know more." And if they actually did, it would have been great, but they didn't. They were absolutely useless. So putting the right team together, which is way harder than you can imagine, getting people to understand the pressures that the employer is under, not just to the employees, so working as a real team, because I had one person come into the factory, and I'll do this in a Geordie accent because I'm allowed to. And they were saying, "Oh, it's all right for you. You're loaded, like, you've got an easy life, where the work is." And she'd only been in there 2 weeks, and everyone just looked because they know that I work my socks off. And they thought, "Oh," and I said, and I just calmly said, "Why don't you come and spend a week with me in my life? And you just shadow, you don't even have to do anything, just shadow what I do." She lasted 3 days. She couldn't get up at 4:35. She couldn't like be in the car, then get on a train, then get on a plane, and then go at the factory and then do a million meetings. And she wasn't even doing the speeches or the interviews or the anything. She just followed and she said, "Okay, I'm going back in the factory. It's much easier. I can't, it's too stressful. At least we know what time we start and what time we finish." So I think we all need to appreciate and give everyone value for what they do. And if people did that more, instead of trying to take the credit, it's why I've put a lot of things through Parliament by not becoming an MP and not needing the credit, and giving the credit to the egoists that can get it passed, who don't really want to do much work. They just want to look good and come up with the idea. And sadly, the ones that really care, the really good politicians. There was one lady from up north who would have been a brilliant prime minister. And I asked her, why aren't you running? It was around the trust, Liz Truss time. And she said, because I have an autistic kid and he couldn't handle the abuse I'm going to have from the media. And I was like, oh my God, the media are just the reason why the UK, some of the media, not all, but the reason why the UK is a mess. And the people have the power to stop it. So if you don't buy that newspaper, that's you will create a better country for yourself. So it's like you buying drugs, you know?
Always said that, which is, when one is critical of the press, we must remember that what feeds the press is the public, because we buy the newspapers. If we don't want to see this stuff, then don't buy the newspapers, and then it won't be published. You'll cut off the lifeline to it.
And people will focus on making a difference.
You highlighted something just a few minutes ago, which I found interesting, which is that as an employee, this lady had a job that she went to in the morning. She could then go home in the evening and knew that her day's work was done. As somebody who runs businesses, owns businesses, has, I guess, what you probably feel is a responsibility to the charitable foundations that you support. How do you switch off? How do you make sure that you don't take all that home with you and it's constantly on your mind?
I do. I take
You
it,
do.
and it's constantly on my mind until I take my holiday. So I can, if I know I'm going to take a Sunday off on occasion, then I literally can switch off Saturday. And as long as I keep my phones off and my emails off, I literally am off completely. But I absolutely cannot switch off when I'm on. There is no such thing. I get home and then I literally go, oh, it's midnight. I better get 4 hours sleep, and then I'm up again. And that's fine. I run a business. That's what all business owners know. You want a successful business, that's your life. But when I am off, I'm off. I could never do 9 to 5 unless I was working. Even if I was working for someone else, and I've got some employees like that, I would be thinking what else I could do for them, how else I can improve the business, because that's what excites me, that's what incentivized me. And I think if more people got into work that they loved and didn't and had enough money to live, but didn't think about, taking the big wage check and being miserable all day in their job, they would have amazing quality of life. I mean, I know some really successful people in the city and they don't switch off, but they hate their job. And I love my job because it's making a difference. So it ends up not becoming a job.
But it ends up, I guess, taking over your life to a certain extent.
Yeah, it does, but what is life? Life is doing what you love and being with the people that you love. So as long as you have that balance, and how many people are with people but they're not with them? The kids are upstairs in a room, they say when they come back from school, and they say in the morning when they go to school. So yes, it's not about how many hours, it's about the quality of when you're together, the memories that you create. For New Year's, I said, okay, let's take New Year's Eve and New Year's Day off, and let's go. I found this hobbit house. So we just all piled into a hobbit house in the middle of nowhere and watched Lord of the Rings, the whole 3 episodes. And I cooked. And the next day we went down the pub lunch and sat there for 4 hours playing Uno.
Oh,
I love Uno. We won't talk about the rules because everybody has their own. So my friend bought me giant Uno. So that was just hysterical trying to shuffle these cards. But we sat there for 4 hours laughing, interacting, competing on the game. So when we do have that time together, we make sure it's doing
It's
something
good
that we
time.
all love. And that's what's important.
Heather, you have accomplished a great deal in your life. When I was doing a bit of research about you, I mean, the list is endless, and I didn't really know how to introduce you because there seems to be so many different things, so many areas of your life that you've explored in different ways. How would you like to be remembered?
I just think Heather Mills, the problem solver, because that's what I find really, really easy. I just think in a different way. I realize it took me a long time to understand and stop being frustrated with people how I used to be when I was younger, because I say, what do you mean you don't get it? What do you mean you think this is difficult? What do you mean? I just didn't get it. And now I'm more patient and I've realized that you need to find out what people are, you know, what people are good at, and then help them develop and grow, but never presume or expect them to be able to do things that you would necessarily do in the way that you would. So my businesses that work the best are the ones where we listen to each other. But then when I say this is how it needs to be done, it gets done. Mm-hmm. And that it's the ones that keep trying to oppose, and because they need their opinion to be correct. So I would say, yeah, problem solver in any issue. Trying to make a difference.
Throughout our conversation, it's that conclusion in terms of how you'd like to be remembered doesn't surprise me now. There's no ego in how you see yourself. Would you say that's true?
Apparently. I mean, I don't know. I really genuinely just see a solution when I see a problem, and I think I can fix this. This is what it needs to be. And it's not benefiting me hardly ever. The one business that I have, which is my property business that I run just by myself, that's the only area that I give myself a wage from. I don't take any money from any of my philanthropic plant-based businesses or anything. All I do is plow more and more and more money in from my property businesses and fund my charities. So I don't think it's an ego thing, because it's not about the money. It's literally what can we do with what the skills we have to make a difference.
Well, Heather Mills, it's been an absolute delight talking to you today. Thank you so much for your time. And on behalf of everybody who's watching or listening from Hospital Radio Medway, thank you very much for the time that you made available to us and for sharing your stories with us today.
Thanks for having me. And I feel like I've been on holiday listening to your soothing, beautiful voice. Thank you for the great questions.
Thank you so much.
My thanks to Heather Mills for taking the time out of her incredibly busy schedule for our interview, and for her candour in answering every question I asked. To listen to more episodes or find links to all of our programmes and videos, visit hospitalradiomedway.co.uk. I'm Shannon, and you've been listening to Chatterbox.